All right, our next case for argument this morning is appeal number 071838, University of Chicago Hospital against the United States. Ms. McLaughlin.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Teresa McLaughlin, and with me is Stephen Lyons, who handled the case in the court below. Although the district court said that this issue has to be resolved on a case-by-case basis, the government's position is that Congress never intended medical residents to be exempt from Social Security as students, and that therefore a bright-line test is appropriate. Medical residents are young doctors who have really moved from the classroom into the proverbial school of experience. They've begun their working lives, and they should be covered by Social Security. There's no dispute that they learn by doing, as new workers in many fields do. But the fact that a worker gets on-the-job training doesn't make him a student for purposes of Social Security. Our position is that the student exception was intended to apply only to part-time or intermittent work for nominal wages where the attendant loss of benefits is inconsequential and it simply isn't worth the trouble of administering. And that is confirmed by the committee reports.
How does that square with the regulation, though?
Well, we think that the district court read one word in the regulation out of context. It should have read the regulation as a whole and in light of the statute. And both the statute says that you're entitled to the exemption if you're a student, and that's a threshold matter. The reg says that it applies if you're a student. And then the reg goes on to say that for purposes of this exception, the amount of the remuneration, the place where the service is performed, and the type of service is immaterial. But the rest of the regulation goes on to say that the work, the service performed, has to be performed incident to and for the purpose of pursuing a course of study, meaning that study has to predominate over work. Now, we think that what the Treasury was trying to do by choosing the word immaterial was to refer to the fact that a wage cap that had been a very low threshold wage cap that had applied to work performed by students of non-tax-exempt schools, but that had been repealed in 1950, we think it's a reference to the fact that the wage cap is repealed and that the fact that wages are immaterial is something that's relative to the 1930s-era repealed low-threshold wage cap. And it doesn't mean that compensation can be immaterial as an absolute amount. And we think that this position is supported by a construction of the entire statute read as a whole. We think that it's at least ambiguous for several reasons, and most courts have agreed that it is, but I address it because the 11th Circuit has thought that the statute is plain on its face. But really, a medical resident is not a student in the most common sense of the word. They are young doctors, medical school graduates, and they work in hospitals treating patients. And hospitals really aren't the first thing you think of when you think of a school, college, or university. And the student exception is also ambiguous in light of the larger purpose of the Social Security laws, and FICA in particular, which is that to cover workers during their working lives, and to let them accrue quarters of coverage so they become covered and have them contribute to the benefit, to the financing of the benefits while they are working. And so medical residents really are working up to 80 hours a week treating patients, and they're making a living doing it. So they should be covered by FICA. It's also necessary to read the statute as a whole and place the student exception in context. And so it's very important to note that when it was enacted in 1939, it was enacted at the same time as an exemption that governed interns working at hospitals. So really, if medical residents in their first year...
Is it correct that the category of interns no longer exists? That everybody is referred to as a resident, not an intern?
Well, sometimes...
That's my understanding of the current situation.
Well, sometimes they're still called interns, but the difference is that in the late 1930s, many medical schools required the year before, you know, after all the coursework was completed, before the degree was granted. But if you think that people who have completed all their coursework in medical school and or have been granted a degree are students, then the intern exception really would have been surplusage from its inception. And the 11th Circuit said, well, it's only superfluous if all hospitals or schools, colleges, and universities. But if you go along with the taxpayers' conceit that hospitals have been turned into halls of learning to train young doctors, it certainly would have deprived the intern exception of a great deal of its force. Now,
the district court here held that this regulation prescribed a so-called facts and circumstances inquiry. Isn't that correct?
And yes, well, a case-by-case basis, and you know what?
I understand that term is used throughout by the Treasury in a lot of instances. Do you know if they regard this as a facts and circumstances inquiry?
This regulation doesn't say this is to be determined on the basis of the facts and circumstances. So what the taxpayer does in this case is refer to a chief counsel advice that was never even issued to a taxpayer to rely on. It was developed in response to the Eighth Circuit's decision in the Minnesota or Abfeld case and was designed to prevent revenue agents, to prepare revenue agents to audit refund claims. And there is a passing reference in here to a case-by-case basis, which the Eighth Circuit in Abfeld said was required. But we think that the situation of medical residents, where they're working so many hours, just is not within the statute. It's also interesting that this case is a lot like the St. Luke's case, where 40 years ago, residents went into court trying to invoke the intern exception, saying that residencies had become more educational and they really ought to be covered. And they also said it wasn't fair to cover them because at that time self-employed doctors weren't covered and interns weren't covered. So the Sixth Circuit said, in partly relying on a committee report that said this is not to apply to resident doctors.
I thought that was a decision on the intern exception. And didn't the court actually hold that residents aren't interns?
Yes, I'm sorry if I misspoke. Yes, it was a construction of the intern exception, but the arguments are strikingly the same. But
the student exception wasn't at issue there, and that's what we've got here, right?
Right. Well, they didn't invoke it, but I think, but it was perhaps a closer question whether residents were interns, and the Sixth Circuit rejected that. So
it's an argument by analogy or implication,
yes,
that you're making here, not a direct argument on the interpretation,
right,
of the student,
yes,
exception.
Yes, Your Honor. And the Sixth Circuit refused to extend the intern exception to residents, saying it's really up to Congress if you want to extend this to your situation. So what was the congressional reaction? The very next year, rather than extending the intern exception to residents, Congress repealed the intern exception. It also repealed the self-employed doctor's exception, and it repealed an exception that applied to residents employed by federal and District of Columbia hospitals from 1950 to 1965. So at that point, doctors were covered at all points of their career. the internship, the residency, and when they got out into private practice. And it's also important, and Congress was concerned that young doctors weren't getting the disability and death benefits coverage that they needed. In holding against the government, the district court in University Hospital and the 11th Circuit misread part of the statute. The court in University Hospital read the section 3121B7 as if residents employed at District of Columbia hospitals are still exempt to this day. And the court simply took a wrong turn. They are not exempt. That provision is on all fours with the 3121B6, which speaks to student employees of federal hospitals. States generally.
Well, I think the legislative history is probably goes your way, but how do we get beyond the regulation? That seems to be the sticking point to me. But
well, Your Honor. Interestingly, the Sixth Circuit, you know, had the related student nurse exception in front of it in the Johnson City case, and that court thought that exception was ambiguous, and it also upheld, and even the dissenting judge agreed, that to invoke the exemption, the amount of wages had to be nominal. So we think you do have to read the regulation as a whole and in light of the statute. And I was just pointing out that one court has misread the district hospitals provision. The 11th Circuit and the district court in University Hospital also misinterpreted the federal hospital provision. They relied on the fact that Congress made express mention of residents in saying these people will be exempt other than residents, and so they thought, well, Congress could have also said in Section 31 in the student exception, we mean not residents. Those courts did not understand that express mention was necessary to accomplish coverage of interns and residents, because they didn't realize that there's a statute that's incorporated by reference. It's the Classification Act, which has a list of people who are not covered by federal pay and benefits laws. And if you look at that, it says on that list are interns and residents. So in order to accomplish coverage, they had to be expressly set out as, you know, these student physical therapists, et cetera, are not covered, but interns and residents are covered. So we think that the 11th Circuit's reading of the statute as plain on its face really rests on some errors of law. So unless the court has any other questions, I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Sykes, no relation.
I was hoping it was.
May it please the court. Tom Sykes, appearing for the University of Chicago Hospitals. I can be quite brief. The question on this interlocutory appeal is whether the IRS's extreme position is correct, that stipends paid to medical residents can never, regardless of the facts, be accepted from FICA tax under the student exception found in Section 3121B10 of the Internal Revenue Code. In this case, the University of Chicago Hospitals, a renowned teaching hospital that is associated with a renowned university, asks merely that it be given a chance to prove that its residents are students receiving graduate medical education at a school, college, or university. The district court, proceeding under a bifurcation order that precluded the parties from arguing the particular facts, agreed that the hospital should be given its day in court on this issue. The IRS disagrees and appeals. We need to return to first principles. That is, unambiguous statutes are controlling, and unambiguous regulations are likewise controlling, unless in conflict with the statute. Despite all that the IRS has written and said, it basically ignores Section 3121B10. One immediately notices that the statute, the student exception, doesn't single out medical residents for special mention or special treatment. It doesn't mention them at all. Nothing on the face of the statute remotely suggests that the student exception is strictly off limits to each and every medical resident, regardless of the facts. Put simply, the IRS is attempting to rewrite the statute. It effectively adds to it a carve-out stating, except for services rendered by medical residents. The IRS's attempted rewriting violates the plain meaning rule. As justification, the IRS invokes the legislative history surrounding the 1965 repeal of a completely separate exception, the one formerly accepting from FICA tax all services rendered by for a hospital by interns. The IRS's reliance on the repeal of the intern exception is misplaced for many reasons, but especially because of the disjunctive or found at the end of the 20th exception in a list of 21 different
exceptions.
What's
the rationale for excusing medical residents from the FICA tax? They're making, what, $40,000, $50,000 a year? They're not poverty-stricken.
Well, they're certainly, Your
well,
Honor,
what's
making...
The, well, what's the reason for all this? That's what I find difficult to understand about all this business.
Yes, Your Honor. They're certainly making much, much less than people with that amount of education should be paid. They've gone to
that,
college.
That goes for federal judges, too, but it...
What we have in front of us, of course, is a statute that just articulates standards. The focus is upon whether it's a student enrolled at a school, college, or university, and whether it's employed by the school, college, or university. And we contend that under the plain meaning of the statute, medical residents qualify. They are indisputably pursuing education. They cannot, Your Honor, practice medicine. They can't just run right out and hang up a shingle. It's different than a law student who passes the bar exam and goes out. The license that these medical residents receive is actually issued to the hospital. In Illinois, 2 years of medical residency, a minimum of 2 years is required, and it's similar in most, if not all, other states. So there really can't be any dispute that this is education. The ACGME, American Council of Graduate Medical Education, sets out very elaborate standards. Those are part of the record for accrediting the medical residencies at various universities. And, of course, this medical residency program, Your Honor, is run by a preeminent hospital that is part of a preeminent university. So I think there can be no question that this is an educational experience. I think the training of doctors has certain unique features, Your Honor. They need the hands-on work under the supervision of eminent doctors who've been practicing for a long time. So there certainly are differences from some situations where people are students, but doctors involved in a residency program, I think, definitely are students. The IRS focuses upon a statement in the 1965 legislative history to the effect that the repeal of the student exception was intended to provide Social Security coverage for young doctors. But that same legislative history also states that all other exceptions found in the statute remain available. And that statement echoes the statute itself, which uses the disjunctive or at the end of the list of 21 separate exceptions. The district court below thus was correct in holding that the IRS had not even shown that the legislative history upon which the IRS relies favors the IRS's position. The IRS has it exactly backwards. It invokes ambiguous legislative history to trump an unambiguous statute. The IRS emphasizes that the stipends paid to medical residents are not nominal in amount. But the student exception statute makes no mention of the amount of remuneration or any requirement that the amount be nominal, whatever that might mean. Congress knows very well how to provide for a dollar ceiling in a provision. Many FICA provisions include ceilings or floors. In fact, a predecessor to the current version of the student exception included a $45 per quarter ceiling. Congress...
Let me see if I understand you correctly. The doctors that we're talking about, that is the graduates of the medical school, cannot practice medicine unless they continue their education by some amount.
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. In Illinois, there has to be a minimum of 2 years of residency, and there are similar rules in all or almost all other states, maybe West Virginia or somewhere else.
So what
is
you've done is, what you've done, the requirements of the medical profession simply added 2 years or some period of time to the educational background that leads to the degree.
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor.
If you can't be a doctor until you do this, by definition ought to have something to do with education, I would assume.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and that's exactly our position.
And all you want is the opportunity to demonstrate this to the trial court.
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. We just want our day in court. When we filed the complaint in this case, it's pretty thick. The pleading itself is only four, five, six pages long, but we attached to it our administrative claim, which we filed with the IRS as a predicate to bringing the suit. And our administrative claim in 70 pages, over 70 pages, goes through the facts and the argument. We want our day in court so that we can prove up those facts and our entitlement to a recovery, Your Honor. The IRS emphasizes the fact that the payments, the stipends paid to the medical residents are not nominal, but as I mentioned, in 1950, Congress addressed this and removed the $45 per quarter cap on the amount paid to residents. The IRS's argument that the payment must be merely nominal is simply baffling. Thus, the student exception is unambiguous. Nothing in the statute permits the carve-out for which the IRS argues, and that is what the 11th Circuit held in Mount Sinai. If materials outside the statute were needed to gain an understanding of its meaning, those materials would be the regulations under the student exception, not legislative history, and certainly not ambiguous legislative history respecting the repeal of a separate statutory provision. The applicable regulations go back at least to 1956, with some elements going back to 1940. These long-standing regulations make no mention of medical interns or residents. None. They don't suggest that the student exception is strictly off-limit to medical residents or that the remuneration must be nominal. With respect to the or found after the 20th exception, the regulations reiterate the obvious, that if any of the 21 exceptions is met, the tax is not due. In fact, the regulations set out standards that are flatly inconsistent with the IRS's position. The regulations describe in detail the factors that determine whether the student exception is met. There is no suggestion in this detailed regulation that medical residents have been singled out for special disfavored treatment. Of course, the very purpose of regulations is to construe the statute. When valid regulations address an issue, there's no occasion to consult legislative history because the regulations have already construed the statute. Regulations are ordinarily entitled to great deference, but these particular regulations are even more powerful. Why? Because they have been legislatively reenacted. Congress has repeatedly amended the FICA statutes, including the student exception itself, during the 48 years that the regulations have been in place. In 1972, Congress amended the student exception, but made no change to the construction of the statutes set out in the regulations. Over the decades, these long-standing regulations, left undisturbed by lots of legislative activity in the area, have acquired the force and effect of law. In sum, the IRS's swirling argument does not, because it cannot, account for the plain meaning of either the statute or the regulations, It is simply impermissible for the IRS to try to tease something out of the 1965 legislative history respecting the repeal of the intern exception.
There's a new regulation now that does accept residents from the student exemption. And what's the import of that here, if any?
It has no import here. Now, the government argues that it should be viewed as an interpretation of the prior regulation. But the new regulation, effective in 2005, and it's effective prospectively only, not retroactively at all, does a 180 reversal from the, in my view, from the prior regulation. It makes medical resident services categorically ineligible, as their brief admits.
Hasn't that been invalidated by some court?
Yeah, absolutely, Your Honor. It recently
was
held.
I don't know which court, but
well, it was in the District of Minnesota. I think it was Judge Richard Kyle, if I'm not mistaken, in a case involving the Mayo Clinic. And I'm sure that'll be appealed by the government to the Eighth Circuit, so the last word has not been heard. But we agree it's not necessary for this court to reach the 2005 regulation because our taxable years, of course, are 1996 and 1995, so the regulation by its terms isn't applicable, and we certainly disagree with the government's argument that somehow, we think it's preposterous, actually, the argument that somehow the 2005 regulation is an interpretation of the 1956 regulation that governs and ought to be, therefore be given some deference in the context of this case.
Regulation, as I understand it, purports to accomplish by regulation what the old intern exception from the student exemption accomplished by statute.
It's similar in the sense that
it's a categorical kind of a thing.
It's a categorical exclusion, basically. Now, the old intern exception was a categorical
inclusion.
At least the repeal was removed a categorical exclusion. So, yes, I see the similarity there, Your Honor. The IRS repeatedly suggests that giving us our day in court would be futile. It weaves in particularized facts. If one looks at the appendix of the brief is kind of interesting because it throws in various documents, including things off the website, in an effort to suggest that what's going on here really isn't education at all. That is not properly part of what the district court addressed below. We had this bifurcation order, and by the terms of the bifurcation order, the only thing that was to be addressed was whether, as a matter of law, medical residents are categorically, regardless of the facts, not permitted to qualify. And if one does want to get into the facts again, if one wants to take a preview of what we expect to prove, Your Honor, we've set that out in 70 pages attached to the administrative, in the administrative claims attached to the complaint. And we would simply emphasize that this is a preeminent institution of higher education and a preeminent hospital associated with that, that the attending physicians are full-time faculty members of the university. These are faculty members of the university, not at the hospital. The mission is to educate. That's why this is called a teaching hospital. Sure, there's a patient care, an important patient care aspect to the mission of the hospital, but it's a teaching hospital. Thank you, Your Honor.
How much time? You have 2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, Mr. Sykes relies a lot on the current regulation and says that it's inconsistent with a requirement that wages be nominal. But reading the whole regulation, it starts off saying, you know, the exemption applies if you're a student, and then it says the amount of compensation is immaterial. We say that refers to the repeal of the wage cap. It said, but the tests are the nature of the person as a student and the character of the organization as the school. Then you go on to subsection C, which talks about how you, the status of the employee as a student. And there, because of the requirement that the work be performed incident to study, it's clear that study has to predominate over work in order for the exemption to apply.
Doesn't that just call for a factual inquiry into the specific circumstances of the residency program?
Not where these people are. Their hours are limited to 80 hours a week, and no institution of higher learning restricts students to study only 80 hours a week. Unless there are any other questions, we'll rest on our brief.
Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.